trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause the earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas? We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind.
The most abundant greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, beats of methane, nitrous oxide, and the F gases by landslide. Everyone releases it when they drive, unless you have an electric ride. It's almost 400 parts per million, and the main reason for climate's rise. Deforestation makes it worse when the trees decay. CO2's dispersed, also dead trees can't breathe it in. Makes it hard to cut back our emissions. Temperature is on the rise, all other animals can blame us, because we are where the fault lies, and it's coming back to maim us. Rising climate poses many problems to the human race. Extreme weather like Katrina and Haiyan, we'll have to embrace. The glaciers are melting, and the sea level's rising at a fast pace. People living on the coast are going to be displaced. Certain species extinct, less water to drink. Other areas too wet, floods a big threat. Other areas dry out, susceptible to drought. Agriculture hit hard, coral reefs will be marred.
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until
we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate's on.
Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, where we explore the ways in which we can and must power down in a new era that is no longer exploiting our fellow humans and ecosystems. We believe in building up our community resilience, expecting further economic collapse in the face of abrupt climate change, the end of cheap oil, the depletion of our natural resources, and a possible mass extinction on our planet. I'm Bing Gong, and today my guest co-host is my wife, Eleanor Despina. Thanks for joining me, Eleanor.
Thank you, Bing.
Yeah. And Eleanor, will you introduce our guest today?
Yes. Today we have with us Mary Reynolds Thompson, author of Reclaiming the Wild Soul, How Earth Landscapes Can Restore Us to Wholeness. Mary is a new resident of our Point Reyes community. She's a poet and essayist, and this is her second full-length book and a very beautiful writing on the landscapes of the world and what we can learn from them. Mary also conducts writing and eco-spirituality workshops and retreats, and she can be found on the web at maryreynoldsthompson.com. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you, Eleanor. It's lovely to be here.
Tell us more about yourself, how you came to write, and what brought you to the writing of this particular book?
Well, about 2001, I think, was a strange year for many of us, and a lot happened. And all my life, I've been in love with language, and my first sort of half of my career was spent in branding and marketing and copywriting, but I knew I didn't want to go on doing that anymore, and I knew I was really part of the problem by using my love of language to get people to buy more stuff that they didn't need. So in 2001, I began to train as a facilitator of poetry therapy. And having always been someone who's been in love with nature, I was drawn naturally to the nature poets, the wonderful people like Joy Harjo and Wendell Berry and Jane Hirschfeld and many other glorious poets. And what I noticed was while their eye was always fixed on the outer world, they always returned us to the inner world. And so I began to explore exactly that relationship between our inner and outer nature. And as I learned more about what we were doing to the earth, the terrible, devastating thing that your theme song so beautifully illustrates and talks about, I began to question, well, what's that doing to our internal landscapes? Mm. And what's that doing to who we are and our true nature? And that investigation really sort of set up the theme for this book.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mary, could you talk about the structure of the book? I know you separated into sections of deserts, forests, rivers and oceans, mountains and grasslands.
That's right. I began to, you know, as a poetry therapist, you realize that a metaphor has, you know, so much energy, but the archetypes have even bigger energy. It's like a metaphor on steroids. I mean, they're really powerful. So the book began to be structured or is structured around those particular archetypes that you just mentioned. And then within each of those archetypes, metaphors emerged that really came forth from teaching this work with many people. So, you know, these were metaphors that resonated with me. For example, silence, simplicity, and permanence in the deserts, or this idea of solidity in the mountains, or a sense of belonging in the grasslands. But they weren't just metaphors that arose within me. They were metaphors that arose naturally when teaching this work across all kinds of people. And so they resonated. These were the aspects of each of these landscapes that seemed to most resonate with people.
Tell us about the soulscapes and your methods for exploring them.
Yeah, the soulscapes really are the archetypes, and I call them soulscapes because the whole point of this book is to bridge the false divide that we have between inner and outer nature. And this, to me, is really the key point, the key sort of point of view that we have to shift if we're going to make the shift into a truly sustainable, spiritually fulfilling world. And that's this idea that what's outside of us and what's inside of us are different, and that humans are separate and superior from the earth. So the idea of calling these landscapes soulscapes was really to invite the sense that, yes, they are landscapes, but they are also landscapes that live within our souls.
So inner and outer nature, that's a great phrase. And you're saying those two things
are the same.
Right.
You know, it's we get it on one level. So what we get is that if we put poisons into the rivers and oceans, that those poisons will find their way back into our own bodies, into our mother's wombs. We get that. But what we often don't talk about and that we overlook entirely is that we are also changed psychologically and spiritually when we begin to dewild the world and when we begin to poison and are part of this terrible destructive behavior. And that's what really fascinates me, because I don't think that we're talking about that enough, and I don't think we're aware of it.
I think you really capture it in your juxtaposition of egocentric and ecocentric.
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to create in this book is a model of where that shift of consciousness might occur. And so I have a model within the book that talks about the egocentric model and the ecocentric model. And very, very simply, you know, when we're in an egocentric frame of mind, we see ourselves as separate mm-hmm. and superior to the Earth. When we're in an ecocentric mind, we see ourselves as part of the whole. When we're in an egocentric frame of mind, we see ourselves as alienated. And in fact, a lot, if you look around at people nowadays, you'll see so much despair and loneliness and depression and this deep and abiding sense of isolation, which is so much part of our egocentric model. But the ecocentric model is about belonging, is knowing that each of us have a place and a purpose in this world. And then the other thing is that in the egocentric model, we're very domesticated. We actually become these incredibly loyal soldiers mm-hmm. right now to a system that's destroying everything. But we've become so obedient, so tame. And in the ecocentric model, we really begin to own our own wildness again. And that gives us permission to really feel fiercely about what we believe, not what has sort of been imposed upon us.
It feels like our school systems have fostered a more egocentric viewpoint. Would you agree with that?
I would say our school systems, I would say our media, I would say our economic systems, I would say, yes, our higher educational systems are all essentially trying to hold up a system which says that we humans are somehow different. And one of the things that I say in the book is that really we humans are simply the earth in human form.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a river or a rock or a raven is the earth in their very own forms. And what happens when we make that shift, when we really get that we are one with this earth, is we realize that everything we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. Which is a very old indigenous feeling. I mean, this really talking about ecocentricity was our natural way of being human mm-hmm. over hundreds of thousands of years. So this modern separation from nature is a very recent phenomenon.
Yeah, you talk about how we got here and so forth and
right.
How to navigate in a new way.
Right. And I think it's important to understand a little bit about how we got here, because we assume that the way we think and hold ourselves right now is the only way. And that's the way we are. We're always looking at the water we swim in and thinking this is it. You know, mm-hmm. nothing's different. This is the way it's always going to be. But when we realize that really this sense of separation, which sort of began about 10,000 years ago with the agricultural revolution and this increasing ability then to build up our cultures and our man-made cities and our, you know, our art and everything like that, and then heightened many centuries later through the Age of Enlightenment, where reason and intellect and we humans were the only creatures with minds, I think, mm-hmm. therefore I am, and this sort of growing self-importance of our species. But when we look back, we realize that there again, this understanding of ourselves is a very recent understanding, and that it doesn't have to stay that way, that there's actually something much older, deeper, and truer within us that understands our place in this world as just a being amongst beings.
Let's get into deserts. You mentioned deserts cover more than one-fifth of the Earth. Mm. Are the deserts expanding, and how might that change us as humans?
Well, yes, they are expanding, and we in California can feel that very intimately and powerfully now as we go through this extended drought with no hope of change in the immediate future. I mean, essentially, since humans have been cultivating, I mean, we think of the cedars of Lebanon, and there are very few cedar trees left. So we've been deforesting and creating desert as we go along. But I think as we see desert now, and we feel tremendously and know in our hearts that perhaps the next wars are going to be our water wars, that we can begin to see that unnatural desertification brought about by what we humans are doing becomes a much more frightening kind of desert landscape to be in. So, in other words, deserts, like all of the landscapes in the book, have gifts for us. And one of the gifts that I think this desert landscape really has for us is to say what happens when we have changed our environment to such an extent that it has become dry and fragile. How do we live in an alive and fulfilling way, even within a desert-like landscape? And that's really questions that we Californians are most particularly going to be having to ask ourselves in the years ahead. In other words, how do we flourish within an increasingly desertified, desert, I'm going to get that word, desertification of our state?
Would you talk about thirst exploration, since we're on the subject?
Yeah, thirst. Well, there's spiritual thirst, isn't there? And I think what's happened a lot in our culture is that these spiritual hungers and material hungers have been collapsed into one another. And so what I think that part of the book is saying is there is a hunger. We do have a thirst. We do long for things, but we mistake those things now for having more possessions, more cars, more stuff, and everything. And that's not true. But when we go to the desert soulscape, we can visit a deeper thirst. We can really begin to ask ourselves, what is it that we need?
You're listening to Mary Reynolds Thompson, and she's just written a book called Reclaiming the Wild Soul, How Earth Landscapes Restore Us to Wholeness.
Tell us about some of the writing exercises, like creating a song line and writing a praise poem, and how you teach people to use these exercises as poetry therapy.
Well, one of the things, as I mentioned, I really believe, I love language, and I still believe that words have the power to change the world. That's something that I feel passionately about. And I believe that just as the earth has been desacralized, so our language has been desacralized. And so there are lots of opportunities in this book as you go through to explore through journal writing, through journal explorations, different ways of engaging with these landscapes. So, for example, in the deserts, I talk about the Aboriginal song lines and invite others to create their own song line by collaging and then writing phrases that seem to really speak to who they are. Or when we go to the grasslands, I get people tromping all over the meadows and into the fields and writing a praise poem, because I don't think, which is a very ancient and respectable tradition, and one that we've forgotten about, which is, you know, to love this world, to praise it, to recognize it. And when we do that and we write our praise poems and then we speak them out loud, this shifts our relationship with the world around us. So all of these exercises are really in explorations, and the writing and the poetry is to begin to build that bridge back between us and the more than human world.
You also talk about in mountains. Could you describe how you think like a mountain?
Well, I didn't come up with that phrase, uh-huh, think like a mountain. But, you know, Aldo Leopold, who's really one of the forefathers of ecology and the environment, and a wise man, had this extraordinary experience when he was in the mountains of shooting a wolf. He was a young man, and he was out with his friends, and they were all full of machismo, right? And he went to shoot a wolf because he thought the wolves were bad for the deer. And so he shot this wolf, and as he went up to this dying wolf, he saw the green fire of the mountains in the wolf's eyes. And he had this epiphany, and he realized that killing wolves was not only bad for the wolf, but it was bad for the mountain. And this was a moment when he began to think in really an ecological way, because what he realized was that, you know, if there were no wolves, the deer would proliferate. And if they took over the mountain, then all the vegetation would be, you know, used up and the deer would starve. And so what he began to realize was that in thinking like a mountain, he was thinking ecologically. He was seeing these often subtle, sometimes very invisible to us, webs of connection. So that what seems like a good idea in the moment, when we actually realize how one thing affects another, we have to think. Mm. And it's also thinking in deep time, because mountains are ancient, ancient beings. And they have stood century over us for much longer than we humans have been around. So the other thing that I think about when we think like a mountain is we're beginning to think about future generations. So we're thinking both ecologically, we're thinking about the web of connection, and we're also thinking about how what we do in the moment has impacts over many, many generations into the future. Mm-hmm. And if we change that one perspective of thinking truly about the repercussions down the line of the actions we're doing in the moment, everything would change.
I think that we need to get to our politicians and policymakers, the ones who can pass something like climate legislation, and we're in a logjam right now in our Senate, and we're holding up a global treaty.
We are, and this is part of the problem, is our political system is set up to be short-term. Mm-hmm. They're always thinking about the next election, and they are never going to think like a mountain, and they are never going to think like the Iroquois people about the seventh generation until we change our political system.
So I want to have time for you to read from your book. I'm just going to ask you one last question, which is ultimately, in the book, you have us leave each of these landscapes or the metaphor that you've created there. Where do we go?
Where do we go? Well, I think we go to walking what I call the wild edge. And so perhaps, if I may, I'll read that piece, because it was actually inspired out here in the marshlands in Point Reyes. And I was thinking about, how do I end this book? Where do we go? Because we're not going to go back to being indigenous people. We can't. We've already evolved beyond that way of thinking. And technology and science has grown. So the question becomes, what is next? So if I may, I'll read from
please,
that.
Yes, please.
Walking the wild edge. You walking, your footprints are the road and nothing else. Antonio Machado. I have come to Point Reyes seashore to ponder the ending of this book. The wetlands where I sit is an ecotone, a tidal zone, where the waters from the Pacific pour in to meet the land. When two bioregions converge, as here, we find the greatest proliferation of life, the most species, and entirely unique plant and animal forms. We, too, are ecotone beings, edgewalkers, navigating the fine line between wildness and modernity. Both forces meet in us, 21st century citizens who use computers and drive cars, but who are also creatures of the earth. How do we hold this balance? In this mix of high-tech modernity and wildness is a profound and curious power that we have barely begun to explore or understand. We cannot return to a completely indigenous way of life, nor would we want to. We must learn to navigate this place where the old ways and the new coincide.
Hi, Jerry. It's been
an ecotone is a transition zone, a crucible for change that poses both great peril and extraordinary opportunity. We don't know how it will play out. What is important is that we take small steps to address the imbalance that leans ever more toward the linear and mechanistic. Plant a garden, send your kids outside to play, share your story about birds or creeks or the gentle sway of a beloved tree. Celebrate the way the sun pours through the window pane, casting prisms of light. a friend of mine, who was never particularly drawn to the outdoors, began to walk for 30 minutes every morning in a small wilderness area. When the Parks and Recreation Department announced plans to build a kids' playground under the tall cottonwoods, home of nesting fowl, she joined with 300 others to stop it from happening. Falling in love with wildness, she became fierce in her protection of it, like the mother goshawk that dive-bombed my husband, Talon's Baird, to safeguard her nest. And if I may, I'll just go to the end of this particular chapter. This is really an invitation for everyone. Imagine that you and I have joined together with a community of people dedicated to reclaiming their wild souls. It is a warm summer evening, and our bare feet touch the soft ground as the setting sun lights the tips of the grasses like candles. We link hands and form a circle. We are gently and yet firmly enveloped and enfolded in the curving embrace of our earthly home. Listen to the rustle of the wind. Breathe the wild air. Sense the salty oceans swirling in your veins. Feel how the earth evokes an answering response in your own wild soul. May all the blessings of the earth be yours, and may all of yours be shared with her.
Mary, this book is a beautiful accomplishment.
Thank you.
I hope our community will be able to hear you read from it.
Thank you so much.
When will we be able to buy this book at our local bookstore, Point Reyes Books?
You'll be able to buy it at Point Reyes Books, I am told, officially by September 16th.
September 16th. Excellent. Folks, you can learn more about Mary, including a schedule of her upcoming workshops, at her website, MaryReynoldsThompson.com. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary. You might mention where are you going to do a book reading?
On October 5th at Book Passage in Corte Madeira at 1 o'clock, that Sunday, October 5th, will be the official launch of the book, and I would love for people to join me there.
That's great. Thank you.
Trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until
we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind.
You're listening to KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin, Point Reyes Station, and Bolinas, 90.5 FM Point Reyes Station, and 89.9 FM Bolinas, and 92.3 San Ramon on Wall Valley, and streaming live at KWMR. We are now going to introduce Jerry Mander. Are you on the phone, Jerry?
I am. Bing, thank you.
Hi, Jerry. This is Eleanor here with Bing.
Hi, Eleanor. I can.
Are you on the line, Jerry?
I'm with you.
And so welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Jerry.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, Jerry is founder of the International Forum on Globalization and has done several teach-ins educating the public, going back to late 90s with teach-ins on globalization, was instrumental in mobilizing tens of thousands of people to be on the streets in Seattle in 1999 and was able to shut down the WTO. Other teach-ins were the Confronting the Triple Crisis in Washington, D.C. in 2007, and then more recently the U.S. Pacific Pivot in educating people about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the militarization that's now moving into the Pacific. Now we have a new teach-in that Jerry is organizing. It's called Techno Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth. That's going to be in New York City, a two-day teach-in on October 25th and 26th at Cooper Union. Jerry, could you define techno-utopianism? It's a new word for me.
Actually, that word's been around for a little while among people who write about technology and criticize it. It's just basically the idea that technology is the solution to all of our problems, and that if we have any economic problems, we just have to innovate with technology and expand our use of technology. And if we have any social problems, we just need more technology to deal with them. And it's just technology is the basis of life and existence, practically. That's been with us for, 100 years or so, I suppose, but it's really, really, really ramped up now in the cyber era of people just really having personal relationships with technology that are beyond anything that's happened before. And what this event is meant to do is to start a conversation with the public and help people get a breadth of understanding, or at least the subjects they ought to be thinking about. I don't think we're going to convince people in 2 days with a series of panels that we ought to all drop out and become Luddites. In fact, that's not the intention at all of the event. It's really to start people thinking about what is going on and what are the consequences of what is going on. What are the consequences of some of the major new technologies that are being dealt with now, and what are the consequences of our stepping inside cyber, the cyber world, to the degree that we all have. And I mean, we're all living with cyber tech now to a degree that just 5 years ago we weren't, and 10 years ago barely existed. So what does it all mean, and what, if anything, do we need to do about it, and how does it affect our relationship to the natural world and to each other?
Well, I see you've got quite a lineup of speakers, 45 speakers, including Anuradha Mittal, Vandana Shiva, Ralph Nader, Helen Caldicott, Bill McKibben, and Wes Jackson, including, and then several more. Can you give us an idea of what the new technologies are that we should be concerned about?
Well, we won't be able to cover the whole territory in a couple of days, but the idea is to, as I say, create interest in the subject and awareness of some of the things that are going on. And one of the areas will cover very specific technologies. I mean, the program will proceed from broad discussions of worldviews, that is to say, the immersion of anthropocentric thinking, the real burst of enthusiasm for the ideas that human beings are in charge of nature and we are as gods, over nature, and that it's our job to redesign nature and exploit nature to the degree that we want, and so on. And so part of the discussion will be really about what are the operating worldviews today and where they come from, and to what degree are we now enclosed within a kind of mechanistic worldview and a kind of superiority to nature worldview. And there'll be a lot of discussion of what the effects on nature have been lately, and the situation of the planet. The coming sixth extinction of one-third of all species apparently are going to get wiped out in the next couple of decades, and we're already losing a tremendous number of forests. The water supply in the world is disappearing rapidly. We all know about climate change, and and we ought to know more about it, and the effects on the Earth from recent economic and technological behavior are very, very clear and horrible, and so we'll go into that, and then we're going to get around to specific technologies. There's a section of the event which we call the Quest for New Nature, and what that really is about is the new thrust of technology is really about redesigning nature. In other words, the solution to climate change, and well, Clive Hamilton will be speaking about this. He's this fantastic activist on climate change issues from Australia, Clive Hamilton. The solution to climate change, as far as corporations are concerned, is geoengineering, which is basically remaking the skies. It's you know, putting new chemicals up in the sky that will defend against the sun, so we won't have as much global warming. Is really preposterous. Another speaker will be Pat Mooney from Canada, who's a fantastic activist on nanotechnology, which is basically the redesign of the molecular structure of the Earth, so that exploitation of Earth materials will be much more efficient than it has been before. It's a little-known area. It's very consequential. Marcy Darnofsky from Berkeley, who's the head of the organization for the Center for Genetics. Now I'm not remembering exactly the name of the organization, but Center for Genetics and Society, I think is what it's called, is going to talk about the ongoing expanding efforts for genetic redesign, redesigning the molecular structures, the genetic structures of human beings to create people that will, you know, be more desirable, taller, smarter, better looking, etc. And this is very, very advancing technology.
Wouldn't it be a better idea to make people smaller? Then they would use
no,
up as much of the
They don't want to make
Earth's
people
resources.
Smaller. They want to make them larger. It's a better idea.
It's not a better idea. Jerry, I was going to ask you about Clive Hamilton. I think, you know, this idea of, I think it's darkening the Earth's atmosphere to prevent global warming. I wonder if you could give us just a little bit of an idea of the fault that he finds in that. I find it frightening, so.
Well, it's just, you know, all of these are about remaking nature. You know, basically, there's the assumption that we are authorized or we are qualified or we are able to redesign the natural world to solve our problems that we created. And so to me, it's offensive just by the fact of it.
Yes.
And he is very good at describing what the consequences of that might be. Because when you make one of these changes in the natural world, it doesn't confine itself to just that particular area that you're changing. It has tremendous consequences all down the line. Maybe you will get a slightly darker world, but how will that affect the oceans? How will that affect the species in the oceans? How will that affect weather of other kinds? You know, how will that affect the whole interaction among natural systems? That's the questions to ask, and that's what the technologists will rarely deal with, because they're focused on achieving
one goal,
some change,
yeah,
that will benefit them for being the ones who are the engineers for that change. You know, it's a commercial operation for most corporations. It's the same with GMOs, for example. You know, it's like, does that really improve food? All that does is it make food growing more efficient and better, more profitable for corporations? Or all the EM, we'll also have Laurie Singer, who will be speaking about the fantastic number of EMF radiations that are now happening now. Her speech is going to be called Adrift in Radiation Soup. You know, we're living in so many radiation fields now that we're not even keeping track of. I mean, we're trying to keep smart meters off our houses, but there's a thousand other things that are being introduced all the time that that we don't even know about. And so all of that is being introduced because some corporation makes some money out of it, and that's why they want to change nature so that we intervene in nature, so that and suggest, you know, benefits from that, and at the same time ignore the dangers of it. So I mean, we're trying to expose all that stuff, and then of course we'll have a whole section of this thing on nuclear energy, you know, from Hiroshima to Fukushima, and drones, and now the new thing is robotics. You know, they're planning to have wars without soldiers now, so there'll just be machines fighting machines using nuclear weapons, and the rest of us get to sit back and get killed by it all. So
sit back and watch TV.
We'll actually have one woman from the Marshall Islands at this event named Nissan Lokan, that I've never met, but is coming to the event, and she's one of a handful of survivors in the Marshall Islands of the original atomic, what is it, 47 atomic tests in the Marshall Islands in the 1950s, which completely destroyed the islands and created unbelievably terrible situation for most of those islands, and has caused tremendous rates of cancer and other diseases among the peoples, and she's one of the survivors of that, and will speak about that whole experience. And Helen Caldicott will also be there to speak about nuclear energy and nuclear war and so on.
Well, going back to the nuclear issue, is what really gets me is that we don't know what to do with the spent fuel.
Yeah.
And we went ahead with this technology, and hundreds of thousands of years, if we're still here, we'll have to deal with
right.
that radioactivity.
Well, that's true of all these technologies. I mean, that is a particularly gigantic effect, the nuclear effect. I mean, gigantic and visible. I mean, it's like that's one we can easily understand. You know, it's so big. The effects of atomic bombs and the effects of Fukushima and the effects of nuclear energy in general when something goes wrong, it's so big that it's highly visible. But many of these other things like nanotechnology and geoengineering and synthetic biology and GMOs, and all, these are more subtle and nuanced effects that you only find out about years down the road. You don't even know about them for the most of the time that they're happening. And so that raises questions about the whole drift of technology and what we know about it and what we're capable of understanding about it, and how we, you know, how we are able to deal with it, and what democratic processes exist to confront it. And in some ways, the nuclear one is the clearest, most easy to understand, also out of control, even so. But all these, there's so many other ones that we're not even on top of at all. We don't really follow what's going on at all, and don't see the effects as visibly as we maybe will see. If a Fukushima happens, you get to actually see what some of the consequences are, although you don't see the radiation that's in the water, you know, around California from Fukushima, for example. But you don't see that, but you at least know that a giant event has happened, whereas these other things, you don't even know about it.
Yeah.
So it's really, really miserable.
And it's ongoing.
And it's ongoing, mm-hmm. and it's multidimensional, and there's no processes for tamping it down. And now we have this whole new cyber world. I mean, everybody's on their computers and their iPads and their texting, and you walk down the street and half the people on the street are looking at their phones as they're walking or using their thumbs to. In New York, I was in New York recently, and I was walking down the street. I mean, I swear, I saw this woman coming right at me, you know, working on her phone. And I thought to myself, I'm just going to keep walking.
Did she run into you?
No, actually, she got about two steps from me. Without ever looking up, she swerves around me. The third eye operating on this one, you know, because she never looked up once and never caught my eye, never did anything, but she did move around me. So a new human capability
right.
is developing now. See? Maybe the third eye is getting visible in other ways than it used to.
We seem to still have some instincts left. The instinct to swerve while using the cell phone.
I guess so. But, I mean, it's so many of those images. And to me, that's the immersion. I mean, that's so recent. I can't even believe how recent it is, you know.
Yes.
5 years ago, it wasn't like that, really. And 10 years ago, it really wasn't like that. And 15 years ago, it didn't exist.
Yes.
And it's like that is so new, and it's so fast, and the immersion is so strong that that people just have not even grasped it. Well, one of our speakers is going to be this guy, Douglas Rushkoff. Maybe you've read his book. It's called Present Shock, and it's about everything is all happening at once right now. It's all happening at once. And the cyber world keeps you in the present to that degree and destroys your sense of connection to anything else. You know, it's so immersive. You're so involved in it. So much of your attention goes to it. And you are so involved in it so much of the day that sort of that's your world, you know, And of course, this whole event, which is Technotopism and the Fate of the Earth, we're trying to bring forth what the consequences to the planet are of all these things. And in this case, it's just like, what does it mean if consciousness has moved from a generalized Port Reyes, West Marin consciousness, you know, where you can see nature all around you, and instead you're immersed so much in technology and in these instruments and in these images that come from these instruments. I mean, I've written a book about television years ago where I talked about the effect of images how powerful artificial imagery is that comes from media. And now people are spending so many hours a day completely inside that world that it's just, we don't know the consequences of that, but I'm pretty sure it's alienation. I'm pretty sure
yes.
further alienation from the natural world and from nature and probably from each other too. I mean, it's all about cyber communications. I mean, and we're all quite, I mean, I myself, I spend a fair amount of the day on my computer, you know, sending messages and looking
yes.
things up and so on. And it's just really taken over. So what does all that mean? Where's it going? And should we be doing that? And what are the consequences of that? And how do we get out of it if it's not good?
Well, this is so perfect as a follow-up after Mary Reynolds Thompson, who was here during the first half hour talking about her new book. And she used this phrase, holding the balance between modernity and Earth. And I know, you know, what I'm noticing in my life is that balance is you're not standing there with both feet level on the seesaw. It's a constant movement where you're rebalancing every second. And I wonder what your thoughts about this balance are.
Well, I mean, yeah, I that sounds very, very interesting. I'd like to see that book. What's it called?
It's called Reclaiming the Wild Soul, How Earth Landscapes Can Restore Us to Wholeness. And it's quite good. She's a new resident of Point Reyes, and she actually quotes you in the book, Jerry.
Oh, good.
The absence of the sacred, your bit about the caribou, killing the caribou.
Uh-huh. Reclaiming the Wild Soul.
Yes.
I'll check that out for sure.
Yeah, it's just coming out in the next 2 weeks.
Is it in the local bookstore there?
It will be there on the 16th yeah. of September. Yay.
Is she speaking there?
She's actually speaking at Book Passage on October
5th, I believe.
Yeah.
But you can go to her website, maryreynoldsthompson.com, and see her schedule. But
this issue of balance, I wonder.
I think your point is very, very good on that, because that is what we're doing this event about. You know, in some ways, it's perfect for what we're up to. And I'll see if we can have room on the program, which maybe sure to come and talk about this, because it seems very, very, very apt, very, very apt. And that is the problem that we're facing, is how can you make a bridge between living with nature and experiencing nature and being in nature and understanding nature and being and considering oneself part of nature, and the kind of immersion that's involved in immersing in these incredible machines that are so dominant. I mean, they were already dominant before we had computer, you know, but at least the machine that we used before, the car, the telephone, television is similar to computers, but most of the machines we operated before are not as immersive in our bodies as the kind of cyber communications we do now that are just so that we ingest to such a degree and become part of, become enveloped by to a much greater degree, I think, than prior technological. And it's just an example of where things are going. It's very, very bad.
Yes.
My thoughts on balancing things out is a practice I learned in the Ecology of Leadership at Regenerative Design Institute, and that was to have a sit spot every day, dedicating 15, 20 minutes just to going outside in a quiet spot in the natural world and reconnect.
That's great, Bing. Mm. Who has time for that?
You know? Well, you got to make time. It's just if it's so important to do, and I feel revived and revitalized
by doing
that.
It's a very very good practice. It's a very good practice. I'm sure it's very rewarding. It's like a meditation, except it's also meditating in the wild or with the wild or.
And being grateful.
Ingesting the wild, and also being able to be grateful directly to it. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I may try that myself.
Yeah.
I'll join you.
Yes, and you're right there in Bolinas. You're right next to the ocean and all of that. So anyway, I want to thank you for joining us today, Jerry. We've been talking about techno-utopianism and the fate of the Earth, a two-day teach-in in New York City on October 25th and 26th.
And if anybody in your audience wants to go to it, there are tickets available at Brown Paper Tickets.
Yeah, and that's at Cooper Union, and you can find out more about it at the International Forum on Globalization's website, ifg.org.
Right.
Yeah. So, and I will be bringing back material. I think you're going to record the speakers, so we hope to bring back content of the two-day teach-in and air it here on KWMR in probably October and November.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Take
care now. We'll see you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So I'd also like to announce that Eleanor and I are going to New York City for the UN Climate Summit. Ban Ki-moon is convened heads of state to urge them to act on the climate because nothing has been progressing at all and because of the logjam in our political system. So we're urging hundreds of thousands of people to come on the streets in New York on September 21st. I'm taking the People's Climate Train with several other activists, and Eleanor's going to meet me there.
And last night we saw a very powerful movie that's been put out by 350.org and its colleagues called, is it Disruption, Bing?
Yes, that was the
Disruption.
Title.
If you might look it up online, it's a really amazing summary of where we are with regard to climate change.
And we'll also be interviewed on Epicenter, a West Marin contingent that's going to New York City for the UN climate negotiations. And that will be on Thursday on Epicenter at 5 p.m., we'll be joined with Chris Brown and other Main Street Moms and Carrie Nelson, who works at Spirit Rock. So, and I will also be bringing back material on what's going to be happening there. I'm bringing my new camcorder. And so please join us on Epicenter Thursday at 5 p.m.
And if you're interested in going to New York, get in touch because number of people are going, and we know of places where activists can stay for free, so there's still a chance for you to go.
Okay, thank you, Eleanor, for being my co-host today.
My pleasure, Bing.
Trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We have waited too long, act now, before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until
we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate, climate's on my mind. It's on my mind, the climate, climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind.
Most abundant greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, beats of methane, nitrous oxide, and the F gases by landslide. Everyone releases it when they drive, unless you have an electric ride. It's almost 400 parts per million, and the main reason for climate's rise.